Welcome to the Dear Love Joy podcast. This morning's special guest, actually it's this afternoon, isn't it, is Alex Polizzi. Welcome to my kitchen. Do you like it?
Yes, I love your house.
Thank you very much. This is the first time we're ever filming it, so...
I feel very honoured.
Yeah, it could work. We'll see how it goes. Now, all my guests always buy a present. I didn't know what to get you, because I often buy people wine or food and things like that. But I was in a really lovely deli and I saw these.
Amoretti biscuits.
Is that
delicious.
What they were?
Yeah.
So I didn't know what they were.
Delicious.
But I just thought they looked nice because they were all individually wrapped. So that's your present.
Thank
but
you.
I said to the person who served me, what are these? And they went, I don't know.
And this is a wonderful brand. And Brutti e Buoni means ugly but delicious.
Wow. So do you like those?
Have I done well? You've done so well. Thank you.
Excellent. So for anyone who doesn't know who you are, which everyone knows who you are, can you explain? You come from a long line of hoteliers and restaurateurs and things, don't you?
So I'm the third generation of my family who are involved in the hospitality business. So my grandfather was Charles Forte, who basically reinvented British hotels after the Second World War. And he was an Italian peasant, an immigrant, came from a peasant family in Italy. His parents brought him over to Scotland when he was about 5 or 6. He was very short, about 5'6", and extravagantly moustached and completely charming, a kind of very dapper, glamorous Italian in a rather post-war Britain, I imagine. Anyway, he did incredibly well from these rather inauspicious beginnings. He built up a huge hotel company. It had 800 hotels at one point.
800?
Yep. And it had little chefs and travel lodges and his eponymous Forte hotels that went all the way from luxury, you know, five-star grand deluxe, like the Georges V in Paris, for example. One of my favourite memories. And then my uncle took over, but by then the company was obviously publicly listed. And about 20 years ago now, we had a hostile takeover. So the family got lots of money, but we lost the hotel group. And by then I had already launched into my own career in hotels. And I had worked in lots, and for my mother, who's another one who does hotels. And then 10 years ago, I was asked to become a hotel inspector for Channel 5. And so I've done that now for 11 series.
Can you refuse a hostile takeover? What does that actually mean? I don't really understand
it. It means that they are offering a price per share. So yes, you can say, basically, it's down to the shareholders.
Right.
So in our case, we had some individual shareholders, the ones who'd bought and my grandfather had set up. So the ones who had 100, 1,000, 2,000 shares. But in the way of the world as it is today, most of the shares were held by institutional stakeholders. And they went with the hostile takeover. And then the company was basically asset stripped and sold off. So it was a tragic day, really, for all of us. And it was something we fought against very hard. My mum and my uncle, who worked together in that company, tried to persuade everybody not to sell, but in the end we lost that battle.
People just wanted the money, did they?
Yep.
That's sad, isn't it, really?
It was sad because I think it was very hard for my grandfather, who'd spent his whole life building this up, you know, through he was 96 when he died, and I think it really shook his world, and he was never the same afterwards. He couldn't quite get to grips with the fact that, you know, all the hotels had gone. He kept asking again and again, but is there no hotel left? And I think it really broke all our hearts for him.
So why do people buy it and then just asset strip it? What's the
money?
Right, so it's just a money-making
It's a money-making exercise.
That's really sad. What had your granddad done then after the war that made his business so successful? What was his thing?
Well, you know, he just loved people and he loved serving people, but he was also an amazing businessman. I think one of my favorite stories is, you know, how he offered to buy, you know, he wanted to buy something and then they agreed a price. And then my grandfather said to the person who was selling it to him, you know, I don't have the money to buy it off you. Can I borrow it from you? And this guy lent him the money.
Did he?
To buy it from him. Yeah. So I think It was also a very different time in England, in the UK, in the world.
Yeah.
Property was cheaper. There, you know, London. Look what's happened in London prices over the last 20 years.
Ridiculous, isn't it?
Imagine 100 years ago. You know, you could really buy things a lot more cheaply.
Yeah. There's no chance you could buy a hotel now from the beginning, is there, really?
Well, not really. You know, Mum and I have always talked about how much we'd love to have a hotel in London, a really nice three-star, without a restaurant, without a bar, because God knows there's masses of bars and restaurants in London. But it just doesn't make sense financially, because by the time you have bought a piece of land and established a hotel and all the rest of it, you're just not going to make the return on a three-star.
Why would you want three-star and not five? I'm very
to make it accessible.
Right, I'm very ignorant on the star system, but I understand it's quite complicated. There's a list of things like full-length mirror if you want five-star. You have to have full-length mirror, and if you don't, there's not a chance you can get a five-star. Is that things like that true?
It is true, and it's things like having a night porter and having room service and having lots of things like that. Three-star is what I think most of us would think is a normal, healthy, basic level of hotel. And it could still be lovely, but it would be, you know, the whole idea is that without all the other frills and furbelows, it would be a lot more economic to run.
So were you always around the company, the hotels and the restaurants and things when you were growing up, or were you kept away from it all?
I was brought up in a very Italian environment, which meant that every Sunday lunch was at my grandparents, and then after lunch we all went to mass together. And us children, I'm the eldest grandchild, so there's only 7 years between me and my youngest aunt. And throughout my whole childhood, all that was ever talked about at table was business. And children were supposed to be seen and not heard very much. And so all I heard was about this business that everyone was so passionate about. And then I was, you know, my grandfather didn't want me to work in the industry at all. He said, it's such hard work and it's ill rewarded in general. And I insisted. So I went off and I did my training in Hong Kong at the Mandarin Oriental, because it was one place that my grandfather didn't have a hotel. And so quite rightly, we all thought that it was better for me to go somewhere where, you know, I could succeed or fail on my own.
So was it world domination for your granddad then? How many countries was he in?
Oh, he was everywhere. I mean, 800 hotels is a lot. It's a lot. And if you think, you know, he also had Little Chef, which at the time were kind of groundbreaking idea. I mean, I know we all laugh at them now, but at the time there was nothing like that. Nowhere just to stop where you could get a kind of guaranteed meal. Decent meal.
Where did you go on holiday? You could just pick anywhere, could you?
Well, not really, because we're an Italian family. We all had holidays together and all in one place and the same place every year. So
where was that?
We always went to Portugal.
Go to Italy.
We went because my grandfather was mad keen golfer.
Okay.
So we went to Portugal to the Algarve because of the golf courses. Right. And wherever my grandfather went, we all had to go with him.
Right.
So we travelled en masse, basically.
Okay. You've set up restaurants, though, haven't you?
I have.
Where have you set up your restaurant?
So I've never owned a restaurant myself in the same way as I've never owned a hotel myself. But I, you know, my whole career has been opening. So I trained in Hong Kong, was there almost 3 years. I was supposed to be doing a management training course, and instead, after 2 months, I was offered a job as assistant manager in the grill room. And so I never really progressed past food and beverage. Right. I never did housekeeping. I never did front desk. I just found my métier, felt madly in love, and I was really good at it. And so then I came back and I worked for Marco Pierre White. I opened the Criterion Brasserie for him in Piccadilly Circus. Which was quite
a... What's he like?
Interesting.
he comes across quite a strange chap, isn't he, on telly?
He's very hardcore. I mean, he's completely monomaniacal, which is probably what you need to be a successful chef, but it's quite wearing to be around.
What does that word mean? Sorry,
it just means he only thinks about what, you know, whatever he's thinking about, it's only that he thinks about at any one time. You know, I used to work for him 6 days a week. And on the day that I was off, I mean, every single week. So I'd be off, let's say, on a Sunday morning or a Monday morning. And then he'd call me up at 7 o'clock on my mobile and he'd go, how many people are booked in the restaurant today at lunch? You know perfectly well, Marco, this is my day off. Call the restaurant and find out, you know. And he kind of you know, when you're in his orbit, so every day off I'd have to go and have lunch. You know, he wanted to take me out to lunch or with his family or to the cinema or, you know, he was a, I don't know, he was a pretty all-consuming.
Yeah, there was a stage where he was really famous on TV and Gordon Ramsay was, and I think it was very good for the industry because it you know, it made it quite exciting that you've got these huge personalities. But I wonder if it sort of attracted a lot of narcissistic psychos into the industry because they seem very aggressive men, and I think it, you know, I think it might have attracted a certain sort of person.
It's always attracted that kind of person.
It's a tough job, though.
I mean,
I
must say, I've been out with quite a few chefs. They're tough lot. They're a tough crowd. And actually, I didn't like the kitchens in the old days. I believe things are better now, but they were testosterone-fueled, repulsive places in which to work. I mean, I remember at the Criterion Brasserie, you know, a chef having a waiter up by the throat because he'd slopped a bit of sauce over, you know, he hadn't held the plate completely steady. There was lots of tantrums and lots of saucepan throwing and all the things that you hear about I actually saw happen. So
I think, yeah, I was discussing this on the podcast a few weeks ago, and I worked in the media industry for years, TV for 20 years or whatever, and right at the beginning and all the way for the first 10, 15 years maybe, we were obsessed with being perfectionist. That was the word. Now you look back, it's ridiculous, but everyone's like, he's got to do it. So I'd say to the production team, we've got to be able to tear the script up on a Friday and rewrite it before Saturday morning. And it's just nonsense. But that's kind of the atmosphere at the time. And I think it must have been very similar in those kitchens full of testosterone, you know, and all the fjord sort of anguish and all that. So
yes, but now you see chefs like Heston, and you know, if you've ever been to the Fat Duck, the kitchen is a quarter of the size of this kitchen, so he's producing these unbelievable tasting menus in an area like a you know, cleaning cupboard, and he's doing that in an atmosphere of complete zen calm, you know, and everyone just working away in their tiny little space, putting the little pincer of thing here. And so it's a very different atmosphere that he's created, and it's no less stressful. But I think it is generally accepted as unacceptable now.
Yeah.
That whole, you know, denigrating people and being physically threatening to them. And it's not a great environment in which to work.
I was never physically threatening because I'd never fancied my chances. But it was just everyone was talking about perfection, perfection, perfection. Yeah. I think that's what a lot of these guys said. All right, you're best known for Hotel Inspector. Would you say that?
Fair enough.
Yeah. What is the secret to a great hotel?
Gosh, there's lots of secrets to a great hotel. I mean, first of all, it depends on... I think a great hotel is in the eye of the beholder.
Okay.
Partly because, I mean, some of the best places I've ever stayed have been brilliant because I was staying somewhere that had, you know, with someone I was madly in love with on a beach. Sorry, that's my phone. I'll turn it off. And a hut on the beach somewhere. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But in general, I think that, you know, service is always what makes a place special.
Okay, we'll go through a few things. Can you tell how good a hotel is by whether you have real hangers or not? Someone told me that once, that if you get a real hanger, you know, where you can actually take it home, that means they trust you enough and you're in a good hotel. If it's got one of those little metal bits.
The prison chic ones, yes.
That's when you know you're not in a five-star hotel.
Yeah, might be true that you're not in a five-star hotel, but does that matter? Does that make a great, you know, that location might make it a great hotel.
Yeah.
Or the kind of restaurant or what it's next to, or, you know. I would never judge a hotel by hangers.
By hangers?
No.
That's the only way I do it.
I promise you.
I want to take a room here, but can I check the hangers first?
Yes, or, you know, like someone might say, you know you're in a great hotel because the loo paper's been folded into pointy thing with a sticker on it.
Yes.
Such a waste of time. And also, why would you want someone fondling your loo paper?
Alex, I want someone to trust me that I'm not going to steal the hanger. That's all I want.
Oh, okay, well.
So we mentioned stars before. How do you get them? I mean, is it just someone coming around and doing a tick list? What happens?
It's a bit like that. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a huge fan. For example, my mum Because I've also obviously opened restaurants and hotels for my mother and for my aunt and lots of other things. But my mum's two hotels, one in Cornwall and one in Devon, are not rated because she has not entered herself the rating system, because we do not put a flower on a breakfast tray. Right. Or, you know, it is a bit like that. It's that kind of minutiae that make the difference between a 4-star and a 5-star, or,
yeah,
you know, we don't have 24-hour room service. So as we think that our reputation precedes us, we don't feel like as if it's necessary to have a star rating.
That's great. Is that unusual?
I don't know if it's unusual.
Well, do you have to list your hotel? If you're doing something like that, do you have to list your hotel in somewhere else, like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, one of those type scenarios?
Well, we're definitely there.
Yeah, rather than on just the online normal stuff. Is that what happens?
I think if you are somewhere like, I've just been working up in Blackpool, where there are more hotels per square mile,
yeah,
than anywhere else in the UK. It's quite useful to have a star rating because it helps you differentiate the wheat from the chaff a bit. On the other hand, you know, independent hotels don't have to because they have other ways of getting people's attention.
I was going to ask you, but you sort of answered it earlier, to get a hotel to work, do the guests have to actually eat there? Because surely there must be lots of money involved in the foods, the food type things. And but you just said earlier that you'd like to open up a restaurant with your mum and no food. Is that
a hotel with no restaurant? Sorry, hotel, yeah. Yes.
Hotel with no restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, restaurants are an easy way to lose money. Let me tell you, I'm always going to hoteliers always saying to me, I was wondering, you know, do you think that the solution to my problems would be opening a restaurant? Like, no, don't do it.
Really?
No.
Because I would automatically assume that was it. And then you get trade coming in from outside the hotel as well as the guests.
I know, but how often have you ever gone to eat in a hotel restaurant outside London when you weren't staying in a hotel?
Never.
I rest my case.
Oh, I know. I went to the Grove once around Watford Way. That's good.
Just to go for lunch?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a big posh hotel though. Yeah. With a golf course on it and everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, I just think that in a city centre, there's so much choice. And normally the choice that you can have is more to, you know, you get something to your taste. And restaurants are, if you have to employ a chef and you have to keep food on the premises, whether you're busy or not, you're going to lose money, basically. Mm. And if you're not running a hotel very well, what are the odds that you're going to run a restaurant brilliantly?
It's different in London, though. All those hotels have bars, don't they, and things?
Bars, yeah, big posh ones do.
Big posh ones.
Lots of hotels don't have restaurants, and I think that's a very wise way to go if you can manage it.
Do they make money, hotels? Is it a good way of making money? Would you, if I was to say I'm going to do it, would you advise me to
No.
Okay, there was just this glint in your eyes there. I thought, yeah, she doesn't think it's a good idea for me to do it.
My mum, I always accuse my mum. The hotels are basically a great way for my mum to spend my inheritance. Because there's always something else. You know, if you're a perfectionist, and we are a bit, you know, there's always another project. There's always something to fix. There's always something else you want to do. There's always another painting. There's always, you know, change the cushions, change the bedspreads. Something needs repainting. Let's buy this bit of extra bit of garden. Let's put in layer upon layer upon layer. We need to buy some staff accommodation. We need to buy, you know, there's always something else. So I think hotels are a way to make money. You can make money out of them. But you have to be quite stringent with yourself to actually achieve that.
Okay, and are they long hours even if you're not actually working on the premises? If you've got enough money to afford other staff to do it, it's still pretty long hours, I imagine.
Well, I don't know, because I've never tried to run a hotel from a distance. I mean, when I've run...
You have to get involved,
run a hotel, you run a hotel and it's just so many hours.
Talking about getting involved then, you like getting involved in hotels. You've got a new TV show, Peyton and Polizzi's Restaurant Rescue. Starts 7th of February, 9 p.m. Channel 5. Who is Oliver Peyton to begin with?
Well, first of all, I mean, he's my brother-in-law.
Is he?
Yes, so he's been married to my sister for 20 years. Right. But he's also a judge on the Great British Menu. He's also, the genius who first thought of importing Sapporo and Absolut into this country. He had the Atlantic Bar and Grill back in the 90s. He's had successful restaurants. I mean, what he doesn't know about food isn't really worth talking about. And he's also one of these people who has his finger so on the zeitgeist. You know, he's got the zeitgeist of the moment. He's always saying to me, you know, what's really in at the moment is let's go and eat at this Israeli restaurant. And I go, Israeli? Oh, yes, the queues of people outside and there's a counter and everything. You know, like, who knew? He knows.
And he's very well dressed.
Oh, he's gorgeous.
Yeah, he looks great. That Atlantic Bar and Grill was enormous, wasn't it?
It was enormous.
Why would you take on... Is that a good idea to take on something that huge?
Well, he made it work for all those years. He was the first person to understand the power of refusing people entry.
Oh, go on. What happened?
He always used to have an incredibly good-looking doorman or doorwoman or two. And then you'd literally go along the road going, yep, you can come in. No, sorry, not you. And you're like, really? Oh, no, please. Oh, why? But I'm with my friend. You know, and they made it have a cachet. You know, it was somewhere you wanted to go because you didn't know if you'd manage it.
That's
it was
cool.
Such fun. I've wasted so many hours of my life in there.
Because you always got in.
Yeah, always got in.
All right, so tell us about the show then. What happens on it?
So Oliver and I are, I mean, in some ways it's quite like the premise of Hotel Inspector, only in the sense that we're there to try and help make business the business successful. I think what's different about it is... with a hotel, if something's wrong with a room, you can close a room. It's quite hard with a restaurant to ever close a restaurant completely. So what you're doing is working on, you're having to change things while you're open, while you're on the job. And it is, we did quite a good division of labor, I think, between front and back of house, between food and menu construction and wine lists and service and the business side of things. And we dealt with four restaurants, and it was, well, personally speaking, it's the most fun I've had working in ages. He's brilliant, and we often disagree about things, but that's good in this case because I completely trust his point of view.
No, I've watched the first episode, and did you enjoy it? Because it must be quite a tough thing when you walk into these businesses and just see how badly run they are.
Well, it's what's even worse is when you walk in and in the first interview you have with the owners, the wife said, you know, I've told him that it's either me, our marriage, or the restaurant, you know.
Yeah.
I am not a couple psychiatrist, you know.
That was going to happen?
No.
Oh,
I'm no
great.
Kind of therapist.
They seemed very desperate for your help, really, didn't they? Which was quite nice.
It was very nice, and it also meant that it was kind of fertile ground to work with, which is, you know, it's so annoying when people ask you to come in and help. And then every suggestion is met with either a wall of indifference or refusal or an excuse. You know, they didn't do that. Yeah. They took a really big battering, couple.
And they did.
And they rolled with the punches and they came out of it. Forged.
They did. For anyone who doesn't know, it's an Italian restaurant, and I won't ruin it. But he was just making basic mistakes, really, wasn't he? Which you were pointing out to them. They put their heart and soul into this business. She didn't necessarily want to do it. He did. He forced her into doing it, really, didn't he?
Completely.
And then it wasn't working. And I just felt so sorry for them. They looked desperate.
Well, I mean, he'd done something very naughty, which is, you know, she just found out that he'd been paying the VAT bill with their credit card. Which is...
It was the hardest thing about it was when you started doing the sums.
Oh,
and you look at these sums and it really gets your heart going. You're going, oh no, please just close it and go on with your lives. But you know, won't give it away, spoiler, but you do turn it around. I mean, you know, you start giving him opportunities to do it. And I think he was kind of, to begin with, I'm not sure he was that enthusiastic. Well, I didn't know he was, but he was just not sure, was he? And then he wasn't sure
till the last moment. Mm. I mean, I had to push him over the finish line. He kept saying, we had to cut down the menu so dramatically. And you know, we made some really fundamental changes. And he just kept saying, but, you know, how are people going to come? And I mean, I think the proof is still, we're going to have to see, aren't we? Because what this program will do is it will encourage lots of people to try it out, the restaurant. If he hasn't then put the fundamental building blocks in place, which when he left, he was assuring me the last finishing touches are being done, then people will not go back because you've got so much choice nowadays in the UK of where to eat that unless you're giving a really good 360 degree experience, then, you know, people will go and eat somewhere else.
So you said I shouldn't invest in a hotel. Should I do a restaurant?
Oh, please. Darling, rather a hotel than a restaurant. I mean, if you must, really.
Why? Is a restaurant really hard then?
Well, I think the thing that people forget about restaurants... Well, first of all, have you ever been a professional chef?
No.
Have you ever worked
in
a restaurant?
I've worked in loads of them, though, every Sunday. Have I ever worked in a restaurant? Yeah, loads of restaurants.
Yeah. I just think that unless, you know, what you always forget is that in a restaurant, you're held over a barrel and with the chef. You know, the chef holds all the power. What? It's like my hotels, my mum's hotels. I always think, you know, housekeeper goes down, I can make a bed, clean the loo. Front desk goes down, I can book someone in. Could I cook for 60 people on a Saturday night from a complicated menu? I could not.
No. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, you're only as good as your chef. Though we all sit there and think we could run a restaurant, don't we? We all do. We all think, I know what makes a good restaurant. Decor is important, isn't it? You're good on those things, getting the touches, get the atmosphere right in hotels and restaurants.
Well, hopefully lots of practice tells, isn't it? Yes, I do think that. I think, as I always say to everybody, why is the power of lighting so underestimated? You walk into these places. It happens a lot in Italy, funny enough. Delicious food, you know, fluorescent strip lighting, kind of making you feel as if you're in some horror movie.
Yeah.
I think lots of people just don't understand how much lighting changes mood.
I couldn't agree with you more. I find it so frustrating when I walk into any sort of bar and there's the bright lights are on, you know. How hard is it to get some dimmers in here or just take away some of these lights? Yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it, when people do that?
Well, that's a common problem I encounter.
Yeah, it is. And choice. That's a bad thing, I think. It's like the hangers for me. If there's too much choice on a menu, I always think, I'm not sure this is very good. If there's too many things, then that some of them have got to be frozen. That's what I always think. There's a pub down the road actually from me here. It used to be absolutely packed out. Had a blackboard with the menu on, and it's famous fish pie. And it's always had about 8-9 things you could eat. And then it got taken over, you can get like 30 different things in there. I mean, you're not going to order there, are you?
It was really interesting. In the course of this, of filming this restaurant show, I went back to the Eagle, which is one of the first gastro pubs, and it's Farringdon Roadway.
Okay, yeah.
And still now, it has stayed true to its principles, and it still only has a blackboard, and it's been going over 25 years. The owner is still the owner. He's still there every single day.
Right.
And they still only have the blackboard, and it is still as busy as it was 25 years ago. And the reason I went back there is because he's done that very difficult thing of changing chefs, changing men. It doesn't matter because it's fresh and it is done. You know, there is what there is. It's always at a really good price. There's very little choice. You have faith in its authenticity.
Right.
And I think also, in our world of today, we believe, you know, it's the specialists that survive. So if you want pasta, you go to a pasta restaurant. If you want pizza, you go to a pizza restaurant. Are you really going to eat, you know, I personally wouldn't eat sushi from a pizza restaurant.
No.
I don't know. Call me old fashioned.
I've seen the first episode. What happens in the other? You'd have to run through the whole thing, but are they all pretty much the same, or are you going for different types of restaurants?
Well, there's an Indian restaurant in Leicester,
right,
with Pratik and his wife Bhavini, which is a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah,
And also it was interesting because
is that in your comfort zone, an Indian restaurant?
Yes. I mean,
okay, sorry.
No, because I think the principles of the business,
right,
of, you know, what I can't talk about is the authenticity necessarily of the dishes.
Okay.
You know, I'm not an Indian chef, but then on the other hand, I'm not a classical French chef I'm not a chef at all.
Right.
What I can do is make sure that every dish is on the menu is making the owner some money.
Right.
That he's not overstaffed, that the place looks nice, that he's advertising himself properly, that I peel the scales back from his eyes and he sees his restaurant the way that everyone else sees it, which is you know, I think a large part of what I was doing there. When I went to that restaurant, for example, you know, he had this tagline, Indian fine dining. And then, you know, then you walk along and there's a menu taped to the glass. Yeah. And then, you know, Indian fine dining and a menu taped to the glass are saying two different things. And it doesn't suggest fine dining, really, does it?
Yeah.
So I think I know quite a lot about food. I've spent, you know, I'm 46 now, so I've spent 23 years in the industry. And I've opened restaurants in Russia, and I've opened restaurants in Italy, and I've, you know, I have quite a good food knowledge. But also for specific things, you can always find experts. So
the restaurants you're picky, there's a lot of, an Indian restaurant in Leicester, there's a lot of competition.
A lot.
An Italian restaurant in
Bedford. A lot of competition. Forty Italian restaurants there were there.
Yeah, it's not easy tasks.
Not an easy task. There was a restaurant in Exeter, a gastro pub in Exeter that was struggling because it had opened when Exeter City Centre was a desert. And then the Exeter City Council underwent this massive regeneration programme. And of course, all the chains moved in. So all of a sudden, having been a very busy gastro pub, there was suddenly, well, every chain you care to mention on the street next door. And then there was a fabulous place, I think one of my very favourite place in Hampshire. And that was run actually by a chef. But there it was, again, a different situation in the sense that you cannot just start cooking nice. You can't do the I am here, they will come kind of thing. You know, he wasn't a businessman. He had no idea how to promote himself. He had no idea how to make his offer appealing.
Is there a problem with the restaurant chains coming along? You know, you've got things like Nando's, which are doing very. Everyone seems to love a Nando's, and they're very cheap. They must be sucking up a lot of the customers.
Well, I think one can't be too snobby about it, because it'd be very easy for me to say, oh, Nando's. Ew. But you know, the truth is, people, even people without lots of money, still like to eat out. And if you can fill that gap in the market and make people like your taste, then you're doing something well. However, I do think, you know, most people understand the difference between a Nando's and a independent restaurant that's charging you £35 a head rather than the £5 or £6 that you're spending in a Nando's, and expect a commensurate difference.
Actually, I do. I say it's cheap. I've been to Nando's a few times recently with the kids. It does add up after a while. It's not that cheap. I've heard this rumor, and I don't know whether it's a myth or not. Sorry, I've heard this thing. I'm not sure it's a myth or not. That Nick Jones, when the success of his Soho houses and all his things, is he arranged it in such a way that if only two people are in the place, it feels as lively or has an atmosphere that if there's 150 people in the place. Is that something that you have to contemplate when you have a restaurant? Because there'll be times at a lunchtime or a unpopular day of the week where it's very quiet.
It is true that, and I'm always fighting against. I hate music in a restaurant. The best sound in a restaurant is that hum of satisfied customers.
Yeah.
That little burble. And then you go to places that are busy and still have the music underneath it and that are still, you know, it's that really irritating drone. You can't even hear what the music is. You just hear the thump of the bass or something.
Yeah.
I think it is hard to make a place feel great, whether it's full or empty. I don't know if it's true, that rumor about Soho House, but he's a very clever man, so I wouldn't put anything past him.
Yeah. Well, when you go in there, you see all the little dens and things, don't you? And that's what he sort of does. And I think, and they also spend a lot of time on light. I worked at TFI Fridays, and they made me into an IST, which is an in-store trainer. I hated it. I didn't want to be one, and they made me do it, which meant I had to train up the new staff. And the reason why I was made into one is because I was confident enough to be bothered to serve the staff. You know, the customers, you know, people got really nervous when they got trained up, and I just really wasn't, because it wasn't what I wanted to do for a living. One of the things they told me, which is interesting, was that movement in a restaurant is really important. And that's an American burger style restaurant, as you know. But the reason why they have all those TVs and flashing lights is they say, if you go to a restaurant and nothing's happening, people soon get really bored. If you have movement, it doesn't matter how many people are there, What do you think of that?
That's a terrifying idea.
Do you think that?
Yes, I do. I mean, what? We're all supposed to be, you know, we need kind of cheerleading.
Well, they had traffic lights flashing on and off and things like that.
No, I know the establishment of which you speak. The establishment.
They have sort of, I don't know, rowing boats hanging from the ceiling and moose's heads and things. And that was their theory, is that the people like to look at stuff.
Well, possibly, but I would suggest that it's very much driven towards a market where distraction is useful. Whereas my kind of age and stage, I'd rather not have flashing TVs. And
Alex, I was training
hula
this
hula
stuff.
Dancers.
I was training this stuff.
I mean,
the other thing they taught me, and I do actually agree with this though, because staff is very important, isn't it?
Key.
Right, and one of the main things, you got a good maitre d', you've got someone who greets you at the door who's lovely. It makes all the difference. But they always said that greet your customers very early, make contact with them of some description, which I agree with, and then try and get them a drink as quickly as possible. And I also agree with that. When they want to pay, get them out of there as quickly as possible, because your tip starts going down if they're waiting too long to get them out. I thought what happens in the middle doesn't matter. So the bits around.
Well, I mean, there's definitely the whole welcome is essential. You know, we've all done that thing of walking in somewhere and someone's on the phone, and it must be patently obvious to them that there's someone standing in front of them.
Yeah.
You know, look up, acknowledge someone with your eyes, you know, make someone feel as if they've been seen. And you know that you're going to be attended to. And then, of course, just get some. I'm happy as long as I've got a drink in my hand, I'm fine.
That's right. And there's also a rumour that if you get staff and they're not local, so they live quite far away and you employ them, then they're more likely to invest much more into your business, as in they'll use it as their social life, they'll stay there, and you'll get more out of them, more hours. Is that something you...
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, certainly I'm trying to think, you know, when we worked, the last time I worked in a London restaurant, I mean, I haven't worked in a London restaurant for a long time, but certainly my mum's hotels in the countryside, we mainly had to put up staff, and it was basically our, you know, work was social life. I think if you've got a group of young people, it does tend to be that. It is such
good fun. Yeah, it is good fun.
And it's still, honestly, restaurants are still the thing that I had most fun doing.
When I was working in restaurants, I wanted to work in TV, and I had to stop myself having too much fun, because otherwise you end up just... For me, I'd have ended up just doing that and not actually getting on with what I wanted to do, because you just do have a bit of a laugh. And
such a laugh. And it's so, and everyone drinks and everyone sleeps with each other, and it's incredibly incestuous, the whole thing.
Well, not where I was, Alex. Actually, talking about that, can I ask you something which happened in the news not so long ago? They were talking about sexual harassment for staff from customers and guests. I didn't really seem to notice that a lot when I was working in bars and restaurants, but I'm a man, so I don't suppose I would have experienced it as much. But I suppose you've got a lot of alcohol around these places, establishment. Is it something that you're aware of?
It's hard to tell, because, you know, I certainly felt it when I was in my 20s, yes. More from customers than from management,
That's what that's what the article was about.
Yeah,
I was definitely
invited out several times, rather forcefully. Mm. I just said no every time. I don't know. As I've got older, clearly less attractive, because it's happened to me less and less. I don't know if it's true or not. I would never. I would have always found it unacceptable. And actually, I think whenever I've had staff working for me, and I've been quite in management for a long time, you know, I always felt that I was always pretty tough on the customers, not only who were a little bit too familiar, but also a little bit rude to staff, especially to the junior ones. Because as far as I'm concerned, you know, trouble should be dealt with at the top rather than, you know, picking on someone at the bottom.
Yeah.
So I've always encouraged staff to come and tell me if something's not right.
I was a nightmare waiter, because if someone was rude to me, I'd say, I refuse to serve you. Without talking to my manager. And then my manager would go, why aren't you serving them? I said, they were rude and I'm not serving them. And he go, you can't do that to me, you lose your job. I'm like, I really, honestly, it's okay. I just don't mind that much. Because some people are so obnoxious when they've had a drink, aren't they? It's the oying. Someone oys me. I've got a real problem with being oyed. So
I've always hated working New Year's Eves, because everyone just gets repulsively drunk. Yeah. And then then they start arguing about the bill and they can hardly see. And I mean, twice I've had to take, I've just basically taken credit cards off people because they've been arguing with me about the bill. And I said, look, I've now explained this to you three times.
Yeah.
You are too drunk to comprehend what I am saying. I'll keep your credit card. You come back in the morning. And then there's a lot of arm waving and stuff. But, you know, you just can't, there's a moment where you have to be really tough.
Well, yeah, and it happens in your restaurant, your trade, because there's alcohol around, isn't there? Okay, where do you like staying?
Specifically?
No, I mean, when you go away, where do you like staying? Because obviously so used to it all. Is there any tips for us of great places to go to?
Be just really specific about what you want. Like, right. For example, my next holiday, I am hell of hells going to Orlando to take my children to Disney.
Oh.
Yes, I think oh is my feeling too. And
I stayed actually in the hotel and the Mickey...
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't enjoy it, Alex. I'm
no,
sorry.
I'm not going to enjoy it. But I think what I've done is I've thrown money at it and I'm staying at a hotel in the park.
Yeah, because
Normally, we tend to do lots of beach and sea holidays. Mm-hmm. And I've done all-inclusives and I've done great luxury. And I think at every stage, what you have to do is really ask yourself what's important. So, for example... If I'm going with my, it really matters to my husband and I that we have a door between us and the kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, quite often they say, we'll upgrade you instead of connecting rooms. Why don't we just upgrade you to a suite? Does it have a room between the sitting room and the bedroom? Because otherwise we don't want it. Thank you very much.
Right.
So I think all those things, you know, he likes, we don't like baths. We like showers. I think you must inquire about the things that matter to you that you get what you want.
Yeah. I'm really not a big fan on queuing. That's why I couldn't stand it. Everywhere I went, you had to queue. Apart from the water park bit, that was really good. You could just keep on going up and down the slides. I really enjoyed that bit. But
I'm dreading it. I'm absolutely dreading it.
I'm going to be so interested to know what you think when you get back. You're going to have to let me know. talking about baths and beds, what about the beds in the hotels? I always get this thing where I go to the bed and I always think, a lot of people have slept in this bed, haven't they? It's just one of those things, isn't it, Anna, in a hotel. I assume your mum changes mattresses often or sheets. You can't change it that often, can you?
Well, I mean, mattress protectors and pillow protectors are pretty key, I would suggest. I mean, you do not... I basically won't stay anywhere that doesn't have a mattress protector.
Really? Okay, there's a good tip.
No, because we all know what people do in beds. I mean,
see, that's what I can't. I sometimes lay in a hotel bed thinking, my imagination starts.
I know. Well, I had the experience last summer. I took the children for a week to an all-inclusive resort. And as I got off the bus, literally as I arrived, a lady said to me, "Oi, Alex, you're not going to like it here. They don't have mattress protectors."
Oh, no.
Like, oh, my God. I mean, honestly, it was like my world collapsed.
And what did you do?
Well, so the first thing I did was get into the bedroom and pull off the sheet. And there was no mattress protector and there was no pillow protector, but the mattress and the pillows are brand new. And so I talked to the manager because I'm in a privileged position.
Right, yeah.
And I said, "What is all this?" And she said, "They get so much hard use that it's cheaper for us just to buy a new mattress every season than to do the laundry."
I still think I'd rather a mattress protector than
you. So would
I. I'm going to do that now. I'm going to check every time. Talking about that, I once booked when I was married, up for a surprise for my wife at the time. I turned up and I took her to the ballet and I took her to her favourite hotel, which I think is called, she'd always wanted to stay there, called the Portobello Hotel. Is it called that?
I don't know.
Something like that. The Portobello Hotel, something like that. And we stayed in a room that Johnny Depp and Kate Moss apparently lived in for a while.
Ooh.
And they
CD.
Yeah, no, well, so I that's it, Alex. So I thought it was all really romantic, and so I thought this is good. So then we had a bath, and she said, "This is the bath that Johnny Depp and Kate bought a load of champagne, and they filled it up, and then they bathed in here." And I'm sitting there thinking, really? Should we get out now? It was, I don't know. It's not the nicest of things.
last time my husband and I had a weekend without the children, and it happened accidentally because I mean, I didn't lose them or anything, but, you know, one grandmother asked if she could have the little one, and my daughter went and had a sleepover. And so I said to my husband, why don't we'll do what we usually do, and I'm going to take you off and let's go and stay in a London hotel for the night. And he said, nah. We get into the room, you start complaining straight away. You don't like where anything's put, you complain about the quality, and then the room service is terrible. Let's just stay at home where everything's the way you like it. And I was That's a brilliant idea. So we stayed, we had the best weekend ever.
Do you still get people who live in hotels?
I don't know.
That used to happen a lot, didn't it?
Well, it certainly happened in one of my grandfather's hotel was the Grosvenor House on Park Lane, and there used to be a lot.
A lot of them did.
A lot of people used to live there.
Yeah. Okay. Listen. Everyone who comes on the show, we ask the same question, so I'm going to bang through a few of these with you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that's been invaluable to your life?
Can I give you two pieces of advice?
Yeah, of course you can.
One thing is do one thing really well and properly before moving on to the next thing.
Don't buy a hotel and a restaurant at the same time.
And then the other thing is my darling stepdad always said, don't get it right, get it written. And I always thought that was, so whenever I've had a task, you get it done and then fix it, then fix the mistakes with it. So if I'm writing an article or I'm preparing for a speech or something, get something down and then work on the finer details.
That's very good. I like that. Any life hacks? We often ask people if they've got travel tips and stuff. You must have some of those. And that's traveling you do.
Well, I'm trying to think about my travel. What I would say.
Always check the bedroom for mattress covers.
Yeah, never adapters. Travel without Calpol in your hand luggage.
That's if you've got children,
yes,
of course.
Yes, which I do, yes. So, I would never go anywhere without a good book because traveling isn't as glamorous as it used to be, certainly.
A wise man once said, you're never alone if you've got a book. We were talking before we started this that you like reading. You've got an insatiable appetite for reading novels.
Yes, I do. I bought another £116 worth yesterday, actually.
Do you like actually reading paper versions of books?
I do.
Yes, so do I. I don't read novels. I don't read fiction. I only read fact books. Yeah.
Do you? Yeah. What's the last fact book you read that you would recommend?
Oh, people are now going, oh, God, here he goes again. I always recommend. Actually, I've got a copy here and you can have it. Do you ever read factual books?
Yes.
This is brilliant. This is Megan Hines' book, Mind of a Survivor. I think she's bored of me promoting her. I think everyone else is.
Gosh, thank
you. That book really, really hit home with me. She's a survivalist, and she just talks about life in her terms, and it's really good. Honestly, you'll love it. You really will like
that
book. Okay,
great, thank you.
What are the last books you've read then, if you can recommend any to our listeners?
I've read a wonderful book called My Absolute Darling, which is a thriller, and the surname is Talent. I don't know, I can't remember what his first name is, but I should have remembered that.
I can't remember. I actually can't get into my computer. I keep trying.
It's recommended. What caught my eye was that Stephen King said about it, many books are wrongly called masterpieces, but this book is one. Right. And it really is just gripping. And then the other one is a Sunday Times bestseller called Eleanor Oliphant is Perfectly Fine. And it's about loneliness. It's absolutely brilliant.
It's so weird we're filming this because I've got cramp. And for the first time ever, people would be able to... I've got cramp. And so I had to stand up. And now I can't get into my computer. I don't know what I've done. No, still can't get in. I apologies.
Last fact book I read was The Sober Diaries. Someone who's given up alcohol permanently, realizing that she can't drink in moderation and the kind of highs and lows of doing that.
In your job, there's a lot of alcohol around. Do you have to be careful how much you're consuming? Are you all right with it?
I drink too much, but I'm all right with it.
Yeah. I found when I was working, it became free after a while when I was working in certain establishments. You know, they just go, I'll have some drinks. And after a while, I got bored of it because if you start drinking every night when you're working as a barman or a waiter, it just gets very exhausting, doesn't it, to do?
Yeah, I don't drink every night. I drink quite a lot, probably more than I should, but I really enjoy it.
Okay, last few questions. What's it like to be famous?
Am I famous?
Yeah, of course you are. People recognise you?
really nice. It's really nice to be famous. People come up and tell me how much they like programs that I've done and how much I've helped them. And sometimes, just occasionally, it really...
Is that funny? Is that I'm going to
go around? I'm so sorry to laugh at
that's
you.
That's all right. It's actually my hamstring. That's really painful.
I would offer to rub you down, but it might be misconstrued.
I'm going to do this bit standing up. No, I'm all right.
Sometimes when I do manage to help the hotel or the restaurant or whatever, like the last week I got a lovely email from someone I'd worked with about 5 years ago, Mark Pilgrim, telling me that his father, Harry, had passed away at the age of 90. And he was inviting me to the funeral. He said, you know, my father always was so grateful to you for helping us save our hotel.
Oh,
and something like that is really, really nice. Or, you know, a business that I've been involved with, that an MOT garage in Manchester where I gave some business advice to ages ago, and says, you know, sends me information about having won this business award. I mean, people are quite often getting in touch with me. So then it feels very rewarding.
And you're
what
not,
I do.
Because you're not only saving businesses, you're saving families, probably as well. Because if you're saving a business, you're taking the stress off the family. So.
Well, that's what I hope. I mean, that's what I'm really, you know, I come from a family business and I understand how powerful that is. And it's a worthy task trying to save them.
I don't want to give away what happens in your program, but they smile a lot at the end. And it's really nice. It's uplifting because they just feel like they might have control at once.
And they're always texting me and...
Nice that you stay in contact.
Of course I do. I mean, everyone, and apart from the nut jobs, some of the nut jobs that I've had to work with on the hotel inspector, you know, everyone who seems even vaguely normal and doesn't have either a horn growing out of their head or, you know, a third eye, always has my number. Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm offering a business consultancy. The TV side of it is, you know, is a way for me to get to them.
How long do you give it with someone like that, a nut job as you call it, before you start going, I can't, you won't be told, this is ridiculous?
Well, quite long. Very rare. Only once in 10 years have I told someone to F off, that who I really, really couldn't stand. And then I was ashamed of myself because it was very unprofessional of me. And, you know, if I have to help them despite themselves, I will continue to try and do so.
Final question, last question. What is the meaning of life?
Oh, I don't think there is a meaning.
Oh, no, Alex.
No, I really think, I know that sounds wrong. I mean, I am a Catholic and all that jazz, but I just think, I don't think there is any greater meaning, I'm afraid. I'm afraid I do think probably that the human race will die out and will be a footnote.
You might find the meaning of life in a 40-minute queue for a 3-minute ride at Disney.
Oh my God. I know, how to waste.
Do you know
how
what?
To waste your life.
As it's visual today, I'm going to do my impression of me having fun at Disney because I can do it because it's visual. Sorry for everyone who's listening to this on the podcast, but this is me having fun.
Well, you're smiling though.
Oh, I hate queuing. All right, if people want to follow you, where can they follow you? Where are you on? Are you on Twitter?
I think I am on Twitter. Yes, that's the only thing I do though. I don't Facebook and I don't
Instagram.
No, no. Not at the moment.
What's your address on Twitter? What's your address on Twitter? Alex _ Polizzi _.
As you can tell, I'm not a huge fan of doing any of that jazz. I do it because I have to professionally.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I'd rather not.
And your show is on Peyton and Polizzi's Restaurant Rescue, starts 7th of February, 9 p.m. on Channel 5. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming
you.
And doing that.
That's
I want
really
to hear
fun.
From you after you've come back from Disney.
Oh, don't and, make it worse, any worse than the dread I'm already feeling.
You'll love it. But you can have breakfast with Cinderella. thanks a lot. Thanks. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, everyone out there. If you want to contact us, at Tim Lovejoy is my Twitter address, dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. is our email, and you can subscribe to us, rate us 5 stars. I'll see you next time. See you back.